The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin. Winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
Eric Holder, welcome to The Takeaway.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A conversation with a true trailblazer begins this hour. You will know a lot more about former Attorney General Eric Holder shortly. He poses a provocative question. Should America see the crime scene photos from the Sandy Hook slaughter in December of 2012? Are those gruesome images a crucial part of the political debate? And is the evidence of their power a president's tear this week that was surely brought on by his recollection of those images that he's seen while the American people have not? Also, we revisit the heroin addiction nightmare, a national campaign issue and a local tragedy nearly everywhere in America. We look at 10 years of the scourge in New England. We conclude this hour with a look at the power and value of holding your ground. Charlie Hebdo's anti-religious message proved bulletproof in 2015, while France's sense of itself seems to be bleeding out. We begin with Eric Holder, who has a birthday this month. That puts him solidly in his mid-60s, 65, retirement age. But there will be none of that for the former attorney general.
I also want to continue to be involved in the fight for voting rights, criminal justice reform, both to speak about it and make sure that I'm a part of the conversation, but then also to be a force, I hope, for substantive positive change in the civil rights areas that, you know, I spent so much time on as attorney general.
He was the first African-American AG, also first black deputy attorney general, first African-American U.S. attorney for the D.C. District, first cabinet official in history to be voted in contempt of Congress for the Fast and Furious investigation. This is something he may actually be proud of, taking a political hit really meant for the president. Eric Holder is in the private sector now, and in a wide-ranging conversation about his career and his years advancing the Obama agenda, he began by strongly endorsing the White House moves on gun control announced this week. Can and will they be enforced by a newly empowered Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms?
The president was pretty clear that there is the need for additional people at ATF in order to effectuate the changes that he wants to bring about. I mean, if you look at the way in which ATF has been treated, it's been a death by attrition, both in terms of the numbers of people, relatively small increases that have occurred, and then the unwillingness by the Senate in this administration and in the prior administration as well to confirm somebody. So both at the leadership level and in terms of the numbers of people brought into ATF to help effectuate these changes, I hope Congress will cooperate.
Gun control and Second Amendment issues were conflict points within DOJ and Congress, certainly in Washington. Another one is voting rights, whether we're talking about the Supreme Court decision or talking about the successful prosecutions and successful cases that you mounted at DOJ. Where do you think the Voting Rights Act is headed?
And my hope would be that Congress would take it up and, in essence, make the Voting Rights Act consistent with the decision, I think the wrongly decided decision, in Shelby County by the Supreme Court. There is the need for a Voting Rights Act that will reach the entirety of the United States. Before I left, we circulated up on the Hill a proposal, a mechanism by which all states could be held accountable, all jurisdictions within the country could be held accountable based on their past actions over the previous 10 years. My primary concern, though, is that we're going to see Congress not act at all. This is something that has become highly politicized. And to be frank, I think those on the Republican side of the aisle see a benefit to a lot of the things that have been brought out in various states, photo IDs, a whole variety of changes that I think under the prior Voting Rights Act, the Justice Department might have opposed.
When would you say the impetus happened for you to think about sentencing reform in the United States as a mission and something that you did really manage to make serious headway on once you were AG?
But my interest in the topic really, I think, began when I was a judge here in the Washington, D.C. Superior Court, where I was faced with sending people to jail for what I thought were inordinately long periods of time, given the nature of the conduct for which they had been convicted. It always was something that bothered me. I saw the impact of these laws on the communities from which people were being taken. And I always told myself if I had the opportunity to do something positive, to change those laws, I would do so. And when I became Attorney General and with the support of the President, this is something that we really decided to emphasize in the second term, having done some things in the first term that I think laid the foundation for the more expansive changes that I outlined in, I guess, in August 2013 speech in San Francisco.
Do you think some of this was driven by race, particularly as we see it revealed now, that the patterns of incarceration were so easily voted in, partly because there was a implicit understanding that they would bear more directly on African-American communities?
Well, I'm not sure that race drove Congress to put in place those rather draconian drug sentencing laws. But I certainly know that as we look back at it now and see who was disproportionately impacted by this, that there was certainly a racial component to it. But, you know, there is no question that the impact of those laws is something that I think was essentially unfair.
When you came into office, when the president came into office, certainly the big story was the financial crisis. And I'm wondering if your mission or your agenda in approaching the job of Attorney General changed at all when you understood that the business of governing and the business of certainly the White House was going to be in dealing with the financial crisis?
No, not really. I mean, you know, the financial crisis was something that we knew we had to deal with. I remember we had a cabinet meeting early on where Larry Summers was laying out the depth of the problem. And I remember a chart that we were given that compared where we were in 2009 to 1929. But that did really have an impact on, I think, our enforcement efforts at the Justice Department to the extent that we found issues that warranted criminal or civil resolutions. I think, you know, we were pretty effective in that regard.
Do you think there was a conscious decision made to focus on largely on the civil side rather than the criminal side in dealing with punishments to the financial industry post-crisis?
No, I think what you're getting at in a polite way is the criticism that has been raised that, you know, we decided to give individuals in banks passes as opposed to prosecuting them. And I think that's simply inconsistent, again, with, you know, the facts. And what you have to understand is that these are the kinds of cases, if you could bring them, that would be in some ways career defining. And in a positive way for these prosecutors, for these U.S. attorneys. And the notion that we somehow turned our backs on cases that we could have made is just not consistent with the facts. We tried extremely hard to make criminal cases both against institutions and individuals. But given the diffuse way in which the decision-making occurs, given the state of the laws that we had, the cases simply were not able to be made. And I think that the numbers that we got in terms of fines and penalties from the banks, those were extremely, extremely effective mechanisms and good deals on behalf of the American people.
But if you're looking at it from the standpoint of one of these bankers like Jamie Dimon, I mean, it's a no-brainer. Jail or pay some money to Eric Holder. Yeah, they're going to take this deal.
A lot of people who are critical here have never been prosecutors. You've got to reach the highest standard in the law, beyond a reasonable doubt. You have to bring a successful prosecution. And to the extent that we could have done that, we would have brought those cases. But we also cannot bring cases simply because we feel that people have done wrong. We have to be able to prove that they have done wrong.
It was quite a ride, you and President Obama there in the administration for two terms.
Mm-hmm.
Did you and the president depart as friends?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's an interesting thing. We were friends before I started. And, you know, one thing I think that people should understand is that he's a good lawyer and understands the need for an independent Justice Department. And he never really interfered in some of the decisions that I made. I'm sure that now that I've left and once he leaves office, there'll be things that he'll want to discuss with me and say, what the hell were you doing, Eric? Why'd you do that? You know, there are things I'm sure that he didn't necessarily agree with or understand. And so I think there's going to be a conversation over drinks that the two of us will have about my time as AG.
Back to the gun control announcement from the president this week. He got emotional there. There's been much said about that. Certainly, it's not hard to get emotional thinking about what happened at Sandy Hook and those little kids who were killed. But people in the White House have access to information and images and things that others of us don't. Have you seen the pictures of what happened in that room where all those kids were killed?
It was the worst day I had as Attorney General. I went up to Sandy Hook, a few days after the massacre. People, it was a tragic incident. It wasn't a tragic incident. It was a massacre. And I met with the first responders and the crime scene search officers, and they took me around. I looked at the pictures. If the American people had access to those pictures, if the American people had seen those pictures, the calls for reasonable gun safety measures would have been passed. If members of Congress perhaps had a chance to see those pictures and see what happened to those little angels, I think we would have seen, we would have had a different result. And I came out of that that tour that I took of the school, and they lined up the first responders and the crime scene search officers, you know, grizzled police folks, and everybody was crying. They were crying. I was crying. It was without question the worst day that I had as Attorney General, and maybe the worst day in my professional life.
So those images, you're convinced, would have the impact of the pictures of Emmett Till that changed America's civil rights?
I don't think there's any question about that. To see the bodies of these little angels, to see their classroom, where you have this juxtaposition of all this blood on the walls and the little posters that they put up where they stuff like, what I want to do this year. You know, kids transpose letters and put a K, you know, facing the other way. And, you know, I don't know, Denise or something, 6 years old, and misspells her name. And to see, you know, that the innocence that created those little pictures about what they wanted to do with their lives in, you know, in first grade that year, juxtaposed with the scene of carnage that you saw that was wreaked by Lanza. It was it's something that haunts me, that stays with me even now. I mean, as we're talking about it, I can bring up the images in my mind, you know, too easily.
Eric Holder served as U.S. Attorney General from 2009 to 2015. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Eric Holder says his office did its best to prosecute the big banks in the wake of the financial crisis. What do you think? Was it an opportunity missed? Framingham, Massachusetts. The problem is Holder is limited to the law. The law is supposed to codify our morals and beliefs of right and wrong. Laws are written by politicians that are pressured to build in loopholes big contributors want that protect them when they do these clearly amoral acts. Campaign finance reform would allow us to see who is pushing what. Then we can vote and do a better job. New York, New York says perhaps his office did its best and the laws are just stacked against them. Or maybe some of that money was helpful to the 2012 election. The rich in this country are becoming increasingly untouchable by the law, especially laws that would repurpose any of their wealth.
Hi, Terry from Portland, Oregon. Eric Holder, good man, good lawyer, no doubt. But to say that we did our best sounds a lot like my dog ate my homework.
Hi, this is John from Ridgefield, Washington. Nothing will really change until we change the culture of business and banking that encourages profits for shareholders and executives above all else, including employees, jobs, and the lives of average American citizens.
We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave us a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. And we suspect you might have a thought on another claim from Eric Holder. Would seeing photos from Sandy Hook change the way we think about gun control? A debate over the impact of photographs next. So what do you think of that idea? Is Attorney General Eric Holder right? Would the U.S. have a new outlook on enacting gun laws in the wake of Sandy Hook had the American people viewed those images? Should the American people view those images from Sandy Hook? Kimberly Rule is a former crime scene investigator, currently a professor at George Mason University. Kimberly, yes or no? Should the American people see those images?
I do not believe that it is appropriate for the public to view some of these graphic images.
Okay. Leanna Peter Hagany is also with us. She's a researcher in the Department of Psychology at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She's looked into how emotion factors into jury verdicts. Leanna, what do you say? Yes or no? Should the American people view those images?
Well, emotional evidence can be prejudicial, but it can also be probative, which means that it offers some additional information about the level of harm that you just can't get from words alone. So it might actually help make people understand more about the level of harm that happened.
Is that a yes from a psychologist?
It's a qualified yes.
All right. Qualified yes and a qualified no from Kimberly Rule and Liana Peter Hagany. Kimberly, let me begin with you. What do you think is the moral issue here of showing these pictures or not? And do you think that if they were shown, they would have an impact on the way Americans think about gun control?
My perspective as a crime scene investigator, we take tons of pictures, hundreds to thousands of photographs at every crime scene. And the main purpose to do this is to create a permanent record of the scene and the evidence so that we could present this in court. As Liana had mentioned, these photographs must be more probative than prejudicial to be admissible into court. This means it has to give you more facts of the case. It must demonstrate an issue to the case. They can't be used just to spark that emotion in the jury and help to inflame the jury, because if you do that, then they can lose their objectivity to making decisions based on sheerly the facts. And I think this applies directly to the public as well, that these images, if they are shown, they need to be more probative and prejudicial. I think that is the key, and not just to spark this type of emotion, because I feel that that could do some emotional and psychological damage to the average public member who might not be able to have certain coping mechanisms and to know if they're going to be able to handle these type of graphic images.
So you think Americans should be shielded from these images, but it sounds like you're saying that if they were released, they probably would have a serious and significant impact.
Correct. And it's not to say that, you know, everything has to be shielded. I think, you know, maybe some images, but the really graphic ones, I think we need to be very, very careful, and not only to help to protect the publics, but also to help to protect the victim and also the victim's family. I would always have to think, you know, what if that was my child that was being displayed for everyone to see? What psychological impact would that have on the victim's family and friends?
Well, certainly there would have to be agreement, and the families and the victims' families would have to sign off on any approval of these pictures being shown, that's for sure. Liana Peter Hagany, what do you think? Do you think that they would have an impact, and do you think there is a value in presenting them to the American people?
I think that emotional photographs, especially graphic photographs, can definitely sway public opinion. Emotional evidence has a really strong effect on judgments and on attitudes. And that's only one aspect of it. So seeing the actual harm done can help persuade people who are now against gun control. It can persuade them that gun control is necessary. But that's only one part of the story. Emotional evidence can also motivate people who are already in support of gun control to be more vocal and more firm in their support. So I think that's another aspect that's very important in the way that these pictures could affect public opinion and shape policy, is it would make people who are passive, but they are pro-gun control, it would make them not passive. It would make them vocal and motivated.
I'm going to go back to both of you, to the picture of the baby that washed up on the shore in the refugee crisis in Europe, and how that mobilized people and changed minds in the leadership corridors in Europe about bringing refugees and migrants into those countries. Do you think the American legal system, by keeping these pictures private, denies Americans an element that would allow them to make a decision that basically that emotional component is just not a part of our gun control debate, and that there's a problem there, Kimberly?
Shielding the public from some of these graphic images, I mean, it may kind of deter people from really having a stance or really going to do research to find out, you know, the other facts of what's going on. But again, I would definitely caution on, you know, what images are shown and who decides when enough is enough. Eventually, you're going to overcome the public with these graphic images to the point where this can really start to backfire, because it's going to start to desensitize the public.
Good point. Liana, give us your final words here and speak to that notion of desensitization.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point. Definitely a lot of it could end up having a this kind of effect. But from my perspective, there's definitely a turning point. There's definitely a point to which adding more graphic information can tip the scale. So to a certain extent, it's definitely probative and useful. You do want to see, like the example that you've given is a really good one, the child on the shore. It's not that graphic, but it's very impactful. It's very emotional. It speaks to the level of harm. It shows you a real victim. So it has a very strong emotional impact without being disturbing in that very graphic way. And there's also research that shows that people are more, a lot of times they're more swayed by one example, one victim. When there's an identifiable victim, it actually has more of an impact than, you know, 1,000 victims. Then it just kind of becomes statistics.
All right. Liana Peter Hagany is a researcher in the Department of Psychology at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and Kimberly Rule is a former crime scene investigator and now professor at George Mason University. Kimberly and Liana, thanks so much for a great discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If we continue to criminalize drug addiction, we're not treating it.
GOP candidate Carly Fiorina's stepdaughter died from a drug overdose in 2009, and she's made fighting heroin addiction an important part of her campaign stump speech.
And the system we have today is part of the problem.
Fiorina isn't the only one. Governor Jeb Bush's daughter has also struggled with addiction, and Bush wants to change the direction on drug policy should he ever make it to the White House.
I believe we can solve this, but it has to be from the bottom-up approach. My personal belief is that America does best from the bottom up, and that the federal government should be a partner for successful programs rather than telling which line you're supposed to get in and which form you're supposed to fill out.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently found that use of heroin has increased across the United States, regardless of gender, income level, and age. The rate of heroin-related deaths quadrupled between 2002 and 2013 in the U.S. It's not a new issue for the people of New England. Reporter and editor Sean Corcoran knows this well. He first covered Massachusetts' heroin epidemic more than a decade ago and recently returned to this story for our partner WGBH Boston.
Well, in 2004, I started to notice in the obituaries that there were some young people there, late teens, early 20s, and some reporting told me that they weren't dying from car accidents. So I found out that they were dying from heroin overdoses, which wasn't something that was very common or well known. Young people were using pain pills, and when they couldn't get their hands on them anymore, they would switch to heroin, which was so strong at the time that you could sniff it and just to kind of take away any withdrawals that they were feeling. So there was a whole new generation of heroin addicts on the North Shore of Boston.
And you found individuals who were affected by all of this and followed them. Describe one in particular.
We thought it was really important to make the point that this was a middle class, upper class, every economic strata of society problem. And I found a young man, he was 22 at the time, named Sean Harnish, and he was a graduate of local private Catholic high school. On weekends, he would party with his friends. Friday night might try a pill of some sort, an opiate of some sort. Saturday night might try it again. Next weekend, do it Thursday night. Pretty soon, you're doing it four nights a week, he would tell me this. And then you were feeling dope sick. And that's how he found his way to heroin. So I found him in a little motel room in the city of Beverly. Just the saddest thing you've ever seen. I remember this white blanket he had on his bed. And it had must have been hundreds of cigarette burns. So every time that he used heroin and fell asleep with a cigarette in his hand, he would make a burn in that blanket.
And going back to check out what's changed in 10 years, how is Sean?
Sean is doing well. I wasn't sure if he was alive. He was so close to death. The last time I saw him, he was actually in prison, but I found him at his mom's house, and he is clean. He got clean after a second stint in jail, this time 30 months in jail. He had a three-year-old daughter by his side, and it was just, it was amazing. It was amazing to see him on the other side.
And he had just as clear recollections of those dark days as you do. Listen.
I mean, it was a 24-hour a day, 7 day a week hustle. Like up at 8 a.m., out till 9 p.m. just so I could feel a little high from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. before I passed out and just had to do it again. It was just a sick cycle that you can't get out of. And even if you want to, there's nowhere to go to get out of it. That was always the problem.
What helped him? What was key to his apparent recovery?
He talks about a drug called Suboxone. It blocks the opiates. So if you take heroin, you don't get an effect from it at all. But it allows addicts to get out of the lying and dying and stealing lifestyle and actually be able to get a job and function again without feeling dope sick all the time. So he talks about it as a miracle drug that took him a while to get off that one, but it was the support that he needed.
I want to do something that's going to underscore the real value in this reporting that you've done here. I'm going to play some tape of your former editor at the Salem News in Massachusetts, and she's reading something, and I want you to tell me whether it refers to something from 10 years ago or today, the heroin problem in the very same community that we're talking about here. This is Karen Andres.
A heroin epidemic has hit the North Shore, and the victims are not the usual suspects. They are middle-class kids from the suburbs who start experimenting with prescription drugs for fun. But before very long, they are addicts, desperate to find the next fix.
So which is it, today or 10 years ago?
Karen Andreas is reading a story that we worked on together from 10 years ago. When she finished reading that, she put it down and said, we could print that today because things are not better. They're actually worse, but it's the same type of problem going on.
And the very things that Sean Harnish talks about not being available to him as a heroin addict 10 years ago are still not available?
It was really remarkable. I went to see this district attorney in Essex County in Massachusetts, John Blodgett. He was in my original series 11 years ago. John Blodgett started to say, until we have the political will to have treatment on demand, to give people a way out of this hell that they're in, we are not going to have a solution to this problem.
We can talk about this issue, but until political leaders have the will to step up and tell their constituents that we're going to expend whatever that figure is, it may be billions of dollars, to provide treatment on demand or long-term treatment, we're not going to get out of this problem.
So do you think John Blodgett's plea is being answered by the presidential candidates that are suddenly seeming to make this a campaign issue, this heroin problem around the country?
We're hearing a lot from the presidential candidates about this issue because they can't avoid it. I think they find themselves in the same position that the governor of Massachusetts, Charlie Baker, finds himself. He was running for election in 2014. Everywhere he went, this is what people wanted to talk about. He had to change his agenda. I think the presidential candidates are up in New England are hearing about this everywhere they go, and they've had no choice but to kind of react to it and try to come up with proposals to solve it. I don't hear a lot of people, if anyone, talking about treatment on demand, no matter what the cost.
Treatment on demand, that would be the code word, the takeaway, the sort of test to see whether the issue is being taken seriously. Is that fair?
I think that's very fair. And as John Blodgett said, sometimes you have to tell people you're going to have to raise some taxes. And, you know, politicians don't like to talk about that.
Sean Corcoran, senior reporter and news director at WCAI on Cape Cod and managing editor for our partner WGBH. He loves to talk about taxes, as do I. Sean, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
A year since the satirical journal Charlie Hebdo was attacked by terrorists in Paris. Have you forgotten the details? The brothers Kouachi, armed with rifles and grenades, killed 11 people inside Hebdo's offices. That assault was followed by a wave of related attacks that killed 6 others in and around the city. The attack emboldened the surviving writers and illustrators at Charlie Hebdo to double down on their anti-religious message, that religions get a pass on their role in driving terrorist violence from the timid, secular, liberal world. But in November, the much worse attack in France that targeted random civilians has caused a shockwave of soul-searching about identity, security, and fear. Even today, a knife-wielding man claiming he had explosives and reportedly yelling "God is great" in Arabic was killed by Paris police. Emmanuel Leconte is an actor and documentary filmmaker who directed Je suis Charlie, L'humeur amour, alongside his father, Daniel Leconte. Their film, which is out across Europe, explores archival footage of the Hebdo staffers, editor Sharb and cartoonist Kabu among them, both of whom were killed in last year's attack. It tells a story of survival and clarity in a group of editors, writers, and cartoonists who continue to believe in their mission and don't care who they offend. Emmanuel Leconte joins me now. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi.
You know, Sharb, the deceased cartoonist from Charlie Hebdo, said many times, without freedom of speech, we are dead. We can't live in a country without freedom of speech. I prefer to die than live like a rat. And what it's like to be on that front line is portrayed quite vividly as you speak with Coco, who's a surviving cartoonist at Charlie Hebdo, who speaks about the day of the attack. Listen.
As I punched in the code, I could feel the Kalashnikov in my back. I was thinking of my daughter. I was completely torn. Torn.
Hmm. That was an extremely intense interview we did with Coco. We did also incredible interviews with Rhys and Eric Porteux, who lived, who survived the attack. And these are, I think these are really their testimonies for history, in the sense that, you know, modern terrorism has taken a lot of lives, a lot of innocent lives. And, you know, we haven't had so many people who survived these attacks and also were ready to talk about it and ready to testify on what happened and to leave it as for us as a source of inspiration, of courage and of resilience.
And one of the things that's striking here is that Charlie Hebdo hates sentimentality. And for all the discussion of courage and resilience, they want to be precise, and they resist this notion that Charlie Hebdo is a group of zealots up against another group of zealots. They totally reject this idea.
Yeah, completely. You know, they were just standing up for simple facts, for simple values, values that we tend to, at least in France, that we tend to for a while to forget. We left a lot of space for people who were vindicating their religion in a pretty aggressive way. And as you know, in France, we have a pretty different model and system than anywhere else in the world, but that we're particularly proud of, and that is a product of our history. And they were just saying, okay, you know, we have the right to criticize religion. We do respect the people who believe, but we as a journal have the right to make fun of religion, and especially make fun of the people who actually turn around the precepts of a religion to kill people. They use it, you know, as a tool to justify horrible murders.
Si tous ceux qui ont accès à la parole publique.
If our colleagues in the front line of public debate do not take their share of the risk, well, then the barbarians have won.
So that's Elizabeth Badinter, who's a French author and historian.
Yeah.
Whatever you think about Charlie Hebdo, if they offend you or not, they are taking the risks for the rest of the secular, liberal, pluralist world. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. And that's... to use the words of Elisabeth Badinter that we just heard also, it's too much of a load to carry for one newspaper. People have to share that burden and realize that it is a challenge that is made to the fabric of our society. And that's what we realized as well with the murders, the horrible attacks that happened on November 13th. It wasn't anymore about, you know, choosing like specified targets. It was just killing anyone, anybody who would be happy to live and spend good time in a free society where you can be out in the streets on the terrace and have a beer. That's the people they targeted. You know, hopefully what happened in France will be a chance for people to realize that this common good that Charlie was probably one of the last media to uphold has to be supported by everybody in the society with its own means.
That's really the question here. It seems that, and it may be an illusion because I'm an outsider looking at events from New York, mm-hmm. but the sense of clarity about opposing terrorism that occurred in France after the Charlie Hebdo attacks a year ago seemed to have vanished in the November attacks, in the sense that people now in France are just clawing in the dark, just trying to find something to hold on to, and they've lost that clarity. Do you agree?
I mean, yes and no, because I think the cold sort of realization of what happened in November, for some people, I think for some people in France, they didn't realize that the attack in January was an attack on France. They thought, okay, these are specified targets. I don't read Charlie, so I'm safe. I'm not a cop. I'm safe. Actually, I'm not Jewish, so, you know, I should be fine. These people can't hide behind those fake ideas now. They have to come to the realization that this attack is on everyone and anyone in this country, on this soil. But what you're right is that it has vanished. But it has vanished in, I think, from the front pages and from as an appearance, of course. But it's also because I think we're, as a whole nation, as a whole country, are experiencing something close to PTSD. The shocks and the attacks that we've sustained so far were acts of war. I mean, what happened in the Bataclan on November, what happened in the streets were acts of war. I know personally cops who were there, who were the first people to arrive on the scenes while the terrorists were still in the Bataclan, you know, shooting at people. And they spent 30 minutes waiting for the squads, the intervention squads, to arrive. And they were digging out, you know, corpses out of the Bataclan. So that's a war scene they sustained, you know, under the rifles of, under the bullets of Kalashnikovs. So after events like this, you are in a state of shock. And I think it's not only the people who were close to these attacks, but it's also the... Our whole society is in shock, and that was clear after when we had those elections, regional elections going on, and where the extreme right party on the first round of the election swooped a lot of votes, because people didn't know where to look at. So I think it's going to take time for us to find the right answer to what is happening. But I have faith in our country. I have faith in our values, in our history, in the people that, you know, that make the fabric of this country. And I'm confident in the long run, of course, we'll prevail.
Emmanuel, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Emmanuel Leconte is an actor and documentary filmmaker who directed Je suis Charlie, L'amour Amour, alongside his father, Daniel. And here's something to take with you today. Among the other details of the Charlie Hebdo attacks you may have forgotten in France's year of sadness and violence was the fate of the little cocker spaniel Leela, who witnessed the Hebdo attack and sat loyal and trembling by the bodies of the slain cartoonist Kabu and owner Eric Porto 1 year ago today. Well, little Leela is alive and well after a year of hugs and biscuits, according to the London Daily Mail. Hebdo staffers have made Leela the official office mascot, with them now every day on the front lines of freedom of speech, although she's probably into it more for simple dog loyalty and the biscuits, of course. Be loyal to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. A great way to stay up on the news. No biscuits involved at all. But find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcast fix. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.